From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, John Kerry rejects claims that Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki isn't committed to a government of unity as the insurgency crisis in Iraq continues.
ISIL is a terrorist army that threatens not only Iraq, but threatens every country in the region which is opposed to it, and Europe and the United States.
Also today, the Supreme Court cell phone ruling that's a big win for privacy advocates. And the star of Western classic The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, Eli Wallach, dies age 98.
You know when people say to me, do you do the method? I said, each actor develops their own method. The biggest secret of all is to listen to what somebody is saying.
That's all coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Syrian government aircraft are reported to have carried out bombing strikes in areas of Iraq controlled by Sunni militants, killing at least 57 civilians. Meanwhile, the first group of U.S. forces have arrived in the country to carry out assessments for potential military action. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The U.S. has sent about half of the 300 military advisers that President Obama said he'd deploy to carry out assessments of the dramatic military takeovers by the Sunni militant group ISIS. The U.S. has said any decisions on military action are also contingent on movement towards forging political unity. But it's being made even more complicated as reports filter through of a series of airstrikes by Syrian jets inside Iraq. CNN quotes a local official who says at least 57 Iraqi civilians have been killed and more than 120 wounded.
The United Nations estimates at least 1,300 people have been killed and a further 1,250 wounded since fighting began in Iraq 2 weeks ago. The U.S. economy has shrunk by 2.9%, its worst performance since the end of the recession. The dismal first quarter figure is being blamed on the severe winter weather. Nick Harper reports from New York.
This past winter in the U.S. was particularly bad, and as a result, the economy took a tumble. The minus 2.9 figure is considerably lower than the last estimate a month ago of a 1% contraction. And when compared to the final quarter of 2013, when the economy grew by 2.6%, the first 3 months of this year looks particularly bad. However, analysts predict this is a blip, that the economy has already picked itself up, with the expectation of a second quarter rebound, potentially in the region of 4% growth.
The highest court in the U.S. has issued a rare unanimous ruling saying warrantless cell phone searches by police violate the privacy protections in the Constitution. In Washington, our correspondent Alice Olstein reports that the decision could have sweeping implications for the digital privacy rights of Americans.
Get a warrant. That was the message from the Supreme Court today for U.S. police, who were sued for searching the smartphones of people they arrested without proving probable cause. Going against arguments made by the Obama administration, the court said modern cell phones contain so much personal information about every aspect of people's lives that such searches are more invasive than a home search. As other legal battles about digital surveillance continue, this ruling will not only set a strong precedent, it will protect the privacy rights of the millions of people arrested in the U.S. every year.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The U.S. Supreme Court also made waves in the world of broadcasting today, ruling that Arrow, a new firm intending to rebroadcast content via the internet, violates copyright law. Arrow's future is now unclear, as the nation's highest court handed a major victory to America's broadcast networks. Priscilla Huff has more.
The ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court is being described as a fatal blow to a new business. Arrow allowed subscribers to pick which video channels they wanted to watch, with Arrow scraping off the signals from broadcasters and cable channels and retransmitting them. American television networks pointed out subscribers paid money to Arrow, but Arrow did not pay licensing fees to those channels for rebroadcasting material they commissioned and produced. The nation's highest court ruled 6-3 that violates copyright law. Arrow's financial backer, Barry Diller, had admitted even before the justices took up the case, if Arrow lost, that would mean the upstart firm was finished.
And the upper house of Russia's parliament has agreed to revoke the authorization of Russian troops in Ukraine. It follows a request by the President Vladimir Putin to cancel the ruling, which had been put in place on March the 1st to protect the rights of Ukraine's Russian-speaking minority, according to Moscow, after which Russia annexed the autonomous Crimea region. This latest decision comes amid a ceasefire between pro-Russian separatists and Ukrainian government forces, as our correspondent in Moscow, Natalie Powell, reports.
Echoing the words of Russia's President Vladimir Putin just a day before, the Russian Federal Council has voted overwhelmingly to withdraw a ruling on the deployment of Russian military in Ukraine. The majority vote had been expected at the Federal Council, but Mr. Putin and the Russian Parliament say they are still determined to protect the interests of Ukraine's Russian-speaking minority.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The United States is also working to support Iraq in its fight against ISIL. We need to remember that ISIL is a terrorist army that threatens not only Iraq, but threatens every country in the region which is opposed to it, and Europe and the United States.
The U.S. Secretary of State speaking in Brussels today as the first wave of U.S. military advisers set down in Baghdad. As John Kerry continued to address the Islamist insurgency in Iraq, he rejected claims that Prime Minister Maliki isn't committed to a government of unity.
In the Prime Minister's remarks today, he did follow through on the commitments that he made in our discussions. He clearly committed to completing the electoral process, and he committed to moving forward with the constitutional processes of government formation. He also called on all Iraqis to put aside their differences, to unite in their efforts against terrorism. That is also what we had discussions about.
Secretary Kerry was speaking after a meeting with NATO foreign ministers on Wednesday. For more on the fast-moving crisis, I spoke to our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman and began by asking about Mr. Kerry's reaction to the Prime Minister's refusal to form a salvation government.
Well, Secretary Kerry has denied there was specific talk of a salvation government. He said that idea did not come up at all during his talks with either Prime Minister Maliki or any other member of the Iraqi government during his visit in Baghdad. But he did say that what he got from Prime Minister Maliki's remarks and his speech this week was that he did live up to his commitments that he made with Washington to move forward with these processes of government formation. So in Secretary Kerry's eyes, there seems to be no conflict between what Prime Minister Maliki has promised and what he's trying to do. And I think there's an even bigger interest in trying to align Washington's interests with those of the Iraqi government to make sure there's no further rifts in what is already a complicated conflict.
And Sandra, the US, we know, has already got about half of its 300 operational staff in Iraq on the ground to assist Iraqi forces against the Sunni insurgency. But what's Washington's goal in Iraq long term? And has John Kerry ruled out additional steps?
Well, Secretary Kerry spoke a lot about the Iraqi people needing to decide their own future, but did say that the U.S. does have an interest in establishing a government that can unite the country and the sectarian divisions and doesn't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. And they really want to see a lasting solution. So, of course, in the meantime, there is this security crisis, and I think these training centers, these operational hubs of around 300 U.S. Staff members will remain in the country for a few months, trying to equip the Iraqi army with support and know-how to defeat these rebel movements, as well as the fact that I think the long-term goal is to see out this renewed political process in the country.
There are also reports Iran has been deploying drones and other supports secretly to Iraq's government to help the fight against the rebel takeover. What has the US Secretary of State said at NATO about Iran intervening? Because he's due to fly out to Saudi Arabia this Friday to seek help from other regional players.
Well, he did make a point to say that no country in the region should be doing anything to exacerbate the sectarian divisions that are already very heightened at the moment in Iraq. And he was asked whether he thinks the Iraqi conflict has been widened, whether the war has included other players. And he struggled to respond, really. He suggested that, well, this was an additional reason to get a government in place, to get new leadership in to deal with these issues without external forces moving in to fill a vacuum, as he described it. And so now Kerry is taking this very issue to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, where officials in what is a Sunni-majority country have sympathized with those messages of the Sunni groups who've been violently demanding representation in Iraq. So Kerry obviously wanting to calm regional waters.
Our Europe correspondent Sandra Gatzman. This is FSN Reports. A resounding victory for privacy advocates at the US Supreme Court today after the court ruled 9-0 that police must obtain warrants before searching suspects' cell phones. In what many law enforcement considered a blow to the fight against crime, the ruling found searching of phones without a warrant an unreasonable intrusion. Chief Justice John Roberts said cell phones hold for many Americans the privacies of life. For more on this story and other events at the Supreme Court today, I spoke to our Washington correspondent, Alice Olstein.
The court issued a very rare unanimous ruling and a very strong ruling against the practice of police searching the cell phones, smartphones and regular non-smart flip phones, of the people they arrest without a warrant. And they said this is okay because you're allowed to search just the general pockets and stuff of someone you arrest because there might be something they have that would pose a threat to a policeman, like a gun or pepper spray or something. But the court made a point that the contents of the cell phone do not pose a direct threat to policemen. Thus, there's no justification for having such an invasive search. And they went on to say that because cell phones nowadays contain so much information, personal photos, all of your contacts, all of your email, possibly your medical records, all kinds of things, bank records, including a trail of where you've physically been based on Google Maps or another application like that. And so they said that based on all of that, it's more invasive than a home search. And if police need to get a warrant to search someone's home, they definitely need to search their cell phone.
So a win for privacy rights groups and supporters. Perhaps that's not the case being felt by some in law enforcement. But can you explain how the case actually arrived at the U.S. High Court in the first place?
Sure. So when a case gets to the Supreme Court, it's a law or a policy itself that's on trial, not a person. It's way past the person and evidence level. That happens way, way down at the bottom where it's first filed. And this case came out of a situation in California where somebody was arrested, stopped by police for a minor traffic violation, and they searched his cell phone, and based on some evidence there, they determined that they charged him with gang affiliation and possessing weapons and being involved in other crimes and sentenced him to 15 years to life. And his lawyer said the evidence they got through searching the cell phone was illegally obtained and thus can't be used against him. And that was the case that went all the way up to the court.
Can you just explain to us where the Obama administration sat on this issue ahead of today's ruling?
The Obama administration sided with the police. They said that searching a cell phone without a warrant is constitutional. They compared it to searching someone's wallet when arrested and did not acknowledge the vast amount of data that that a cell phone contains. Many members of Congress were pretty concerned about the Obama administration's position on it. And so this is a loss for them, and it could be used to challenge some of the federal digital surveillance that we know is going on because of leaks by Edward Snowden.
FSN's Alice Olstein. British Prime Minister David Cameron is under pressure over his decision to employ a communications director who has now been convicted over conspiring to hack phones. The jury in the phone hacking trial failed to reach a verdict on a separate charge against Andy Coulson of misconduct in a public office. Mr. Coulson, a former editor of Britain's News of the World tabloid, later became communications chief for David Cameron and worked for him at Downing Street. FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from London.
The Prime Minister will always be remembered as being the first ever occupant of his office who brought a criminal into the heart of Downing Street.
Opposition Labour leader Ed Miliband on the front foot at Prime Minister's questions in the House of Commons. He says David Cameron was warned about Andy Coulson before he employed him in 2007, after the period of the News of the World over which Mr. Coulson has now been convicted of conspiring to hack phones.
This is about his character, his judgment, and the warnings he ignored, including from the Deputy Prime Minister.
But David Cameron insists the Leveson inquiry into phone hacking and press ethics has already cleared him of that charge.
All of these issues, every single warning, was dealt with by the Leveson inquiry. An inquiry he called for, an inquiry whose terms of reference he agreed. And I know he can't bear it, but Leveson made no criticism of my conduct in this regard whatsoever.
But the British Prime Minister was forced to apologise again, this time to Parliament.
Now, I said yesterday, and I say again today, I take full responsibility for employing Andy Coulson. I did so on the basis of assurances that I received, but also the Select Committee received. But I always said if those assurances turned out to be wrong, I would apologise fully and frankly to this House of Commons, and I do so again today from this dispatch box. I am sorry, this was the wrong decision.
Ned Simons of the Huffington Post says this is an opportunity for Ed Miliband to try and keep his opposite number on the ropes.
It's incredibly awkward for Cameron. He hires someone who's been found guilty against the warning of others, including Nick Clegg. The other thing it does is for Ed Miliband, it completely changes the narrative of the last few weeks, which has been kind of going against him. Suddenly, it's all on camera again. He can come out and fight on something that he was ahead of the game on back in when the phone hacking kind of scandal first broke.
Rebecca Brooks, former News International boss, protégé of media tycoon Rupert Murdoch and close friend of David Cameron, was cleared of all charges in the same trial. The acquittal of Miss Brooks was welcomed by Mr Murdoch's Sun newspaper. But Professor Natalie Fenton, director of campaign group Hacked Off, says the UK tabloids still need to change.
Here we have hundreds and hundreds of press victims, thousands of phone hackings. They've got to stop turning around saying everything we do in our garden is rosy. You know, this is that there is some terrible abusive practices going on for the sake of selling newspapers that need to stop.
The jury in the trial, though, has been discharged, and any decision on a retrial over the charges on which it couldn't decide against former News of the World editor Andy Coulson and journalist Clive Goodman, that could come on Monday. The judge in the trial, meanwhile, has criticised the Prime Minister for issuing a statement on Tuesday on his former employee, Mr. Coulson, before the trial had completely finished. David Cameron's judgment, therefore, remains in the spotlight. Ollie Barrett, London.
This is FSN Reports. The United States and Germany are facing off in a critical World Cup soccer game that could decide whether the US team advances to the next stage of the tournament. The match features additional drama because American coach Jürgen Klinsmann is one of the most celebrated footballers in German history. How are Germans reacting to seeing their former hero decked out in the stars and stripes? Ira Spitzer reports from Berlin.
Germany against the United States. A big game for both sides at the World Cup, but a particularly special moment for U.S. coach Jürgen Klinsmann.
It's something that, you know, doesn't happen, you know, every year. And probably not anymore in a lifetime.
Klinsmann rose from humble beginnings to become one of the best German players of his era and coached the team to a third-place finish in the 2006 World Cup. Now he faces his biggest challenge yet in his third year as the U.S. coach, needing a draw or a win to advance.
Obviously gives it a little bit more tension because both are not yet through into the knockout stage.
Most Germans still hold Klinsmann in high regard, but this is the World Cup. and loyalty means nothing, according to one Berliner.
Well, of course, he was one of the most famous football players when I was a kid. So seeing this game reminds me of my youth, but I think, yeah, the better team is about to win.
Still, as another Berliner acknowledges, whether through Klinsmann's influence or just steady improvement, the U.S. team seems to have transformed itself into a worthy opponent.
The completely focus goes from the media on Klinsmann, not on the team. So, and when something goes wrong, everybody fight the Klinsmann and not the team. So the team can do what they want and they do it in a good way. For now, I saw two great World Cup games of the U.S. boys.
Well, Klinsmann will probably be considered a success if the U.S. can just make it to the next round. The same can't be said for his German counterpart and former protege, Joachim Löw, who has yet to reach the World Cup finals. Sports journalist Dominic Bardo at the Berlin newspaper The Tageszeitung explains the long shadow that Klinsmann still casts over the German national team.
When Klinsmann was coach, nobody expected much of the team because it was an old team and he brought in younger players. And over the years, Löw brought on more younger players, talented players who play now for the best teams in the world.
And many Germans feel that this year's team is up to the challenge.
They're expected to deliver. They played beautiful football, but now it's time for some results. If they don't bring it this time, if they don't reach semi-final, I think it can be a very unpleasant situation for Löw.
Klinsmann ruffled some feathers in the U.S. before the tournament by saying that a World Cup title would be unrealistic. But after a strong showing so far, and with American interest in soccer at an all-time high, he could become a hero a second time around if he's able to fend off his homeland and make a run in this year's tournament. Iris Bitzer in Berlin.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, remembering an acting legend. Eli Wallach died yesterday at the age of 98. Awarded an honorary Oscar in 2010 for a lifetime in film, the New York Times noted today that no matter the part, he always seemed at ease and in control. His career was vibrant, both on the big screen and on the stage. He played a Mexican bandit in The Magnificent Seven, a French general in Jean-Enwille's Waltz of the Toreadors, Clark Gable's sidekick in The Misfits, and a Sicilian émigré in Tennessee Williams' Baby Doll, a film that back in 1956 attracted the ire of the Catholic Church. In 2009, Eli Wallach spoke about his career to Neil Gabler on New York's PBS station WNET.
Well, there is, in most of the movies I make, there is some kind of questioning about whether I should do it or not do it. I don't know how I was going to wind up playing a Mexican. What I didn't understand about this movie, The Magnificent Seven, that it was based on the Japanese film, The Seven Samurai. So then when they asked me, did I want to be in this thing, I said, I want to play the crazy Japanese guy.
The Mafuna role.
The Mafuna role.
The young fellow.
Yeah. So they said to me, sorry, can't, because that's the love interest. I said, well, what am I going to play? He said, you'll play the head Mexican bandit. I said, oh. So I said to the director, all right, on one condition. I have to understand what the bandit does with the money. In all the movies I've seen, they hold up banks, they steal, they rob. You never see what they do with the money. I want to show what I would do with the money. So I want a red silk shirt. I want a horse that's well-behaved and loves me. And I want two gold caps that go in here. The first time in The Magnificent Seven, I said to, what was his name, the director?
John Sturges.
John Sturges. I said, my pants are so tight. When I lift my leg to get on, I can hardly lift it. He said, we'll work it out. Don't worry. He said, this is what you do. Walk over to the set, to the horse, lift your foot like this, and I'll cut. And there's a man standing here who goes like this. Then I cut back, and you're on the horse. I said, that's magic. That's magic.
Now, you chose your own costume for this movie?
I did. I ordered red silk shirts, a hat. The hat is a big episode in that movie. A man named El Indio, who directed directed movies, didn't like one of the critics who wrote about his movie that he made, and he shot the critic in the groin. So he was not allowed to be, he was not allowed to make any more movies in Mexico for the Mexicans. So Sturgis hired him to work as an ex, you know, work on this movie.
He was getting good reviews for this film.
I don't know. But he said to me, all right, Eli, he said, we have to have a Mexican hat for you. I said, all right. He said, we go to Mexico City. I know the store. We go. So we go. The man took the measurement with a strap around my head. And El Indio said, now we go celebrate. Now we go have some tequila and we go have a good time. I don't remember that night. I do not remember it. But the next morning, he woke me up. He said, Eli, we go get the hat. I said, all right. We go, and I'll tell you, the hat, it's about the size of a huge coffee table, this big. I said, El Indio, if I wear that hat and the wind is blowing, it'll blow me right off the horse. All right. He said, that is a Mexican hat, and you wear it. So I get back, and Sturgis said, where's the hat? And they brought it out, and he said, are you kidding? He said, all I can see is hat. I don't see your face or you. Props, bring the scissors. And they cut it around till here, till I have a normal hat. And that's what I wore.
You did something very interesting on this movie. You didn't hang out that much with the Seven as much as you hung out with your group of Mexican banditos. Is that true? I mean, you did that. So you did socialize with these.
I did. I liked them.
And did you use the method before you got on set?
There is no the method. You know when people say to me, do you do the method? I said, each actor develops their own method. There are some things you use, some crutches you have. But you have to listen. The biggest secret of all is to listen to what somebody is saying.
What method did you use when you were getting into character before you'd go on set in The Magnificent Seven?
Yul shot me, Yul Brynner, mm-hmm. and killed me. The director said, Eli, I want the light to go out of your eyes when you die. So I thought, I've seen so many actors die and they take an eternity to die. You know, they go, so I thought, I'll make it quick. He said, let the light go out of your eyes. I went, and I died. He said, that was very good. We'll use that. My son, at age 9, said to me, Dad, can't you outdraw Yul Brynner? I said, Peter, if the script says I get killed, I get killed. I can. He says, I was disappointed. You never know. What makes a movie work, I have no idea.
That's Eli Wallach talking there to Neil Gabler on New York's WNET. You can find lots more of that interview and many others at www.reel13.org. That's real as in a movie reel. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And so we close the programme today with the theme from an Eli Wallach classic. The spaghetti western, the good, the bad and the ugly. Don't forget to stay in touch with us on Twitter at Feature Story or by email. You can reach us at reports@featurestory.com. I'm Kevin McAleese, alongside Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a good evening. Goodbye.